Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Immigrant Superpower by Tim Kaine. Narrated by Tim Kaine. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you'll hear references to figures and tables present in the book and ebook formats of the book. For Madonna and Marcella, my wonderful sisters. Acknowledgements. My campaign manager for the congressional primary in 2018 was a guy named Chris Galloway. I credit him for this book because he's the one who encouraged me to run as a Republican with a limitless faith in the American dream. My phone rang at 5 a.m. on Election Day, May 8th. You awake? Already shaved. Ready to rock 'em like a hurricane? 100%. See you at the radio station. And then he went missing. Chris never says yes, and he also never admits he's wrong. His two basic responses are whatever and 100%. My odds of victory on Election Day were somewhere between those two. Campaign staff, even the manager, get terrible pay. They're cynical on the outside, but deep down everyone in politics is doing it because they still believe in this thing called America. I decided to splurge on a luxury hotel room for Chris the night before the election, and it was those knuckleheads that lost his car keys. 3 hours later, he tracked me down with a half dozen volunteers at a busy intersection, waving to morning traffic north of the city. Anthony Lagunzad is holding the big Kaine for Ohio banner to my right. One of my enthusiastic college Republicans is hopping up and down, shaking his sign so vigorously, I worry he'll cause a crash. Ray Hederman, an old pal from the Heritage Foundation, is to my left with another poster. Chris walks over with his luxury hotel coffee in hand and just shakes his head. Did you guys ever think about going to a polling location to wave at actual voters? It was thanks to Chris that the New York Times sent out a reporter to cover the campaign and ran a feature story on my candidacy. It was titled, Meet the Pro-Trade, Pro-Immigration Economist Running for Congress. As a Republican, in Ohio. The party's primary on Tuesday will feature 10 candidates, including two state senators, a county prosecutor, and a local conservative activist. Then there's Tim Kaine. Mr. Kaine, 50, has a resume that sounds as if he answered a casting call for a Republican congressional candidate. An Ohio native, he served in the Air Force, then earned a PhD in economics, and worked at conservative think tanks such as the Heritage Foundation and the Hoover Institution. Along the way, he helped start two companies, wrote four books, and became a familiar commentator on economic issues in newspapers and on television. The reporter, Ben Castleman, was sincere in his curiosity about what was happening at the grassroots level. Who were these crazy Trump voters? It's not that folks around here don't like immigrants, I explained. Every kid I went to high school with could tell you their family story of coming to America, especially here in the Midwest with a thick mix of religions and homelands that had warred against one another in the old world. What folks didn't like is being told that they're racist just because of the color of their skin by elites who have no idea about the hardships many Midwestern families overcame. Folks here can tell you the names of ancestors who fought to free the slaves, who believe in the American dream, who gripped hands with fellow soldiers of every background as they fought for the freedom and democracy of foreigners in foreign lands. I want to make sure to acknowledge the friends I grew up with for inspiring this book, especially the refugee who sat next to me in first grade, whose family had fled Vietnam. My buddies and I helped him and his sister learn their first English words before my family moved across town. I've forgotten his name, but not his face. The writing was aided tremendously by my research assistants and interns at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University over the past few years, especially Jessica Gonzalez, Jason Lin, Anya Koo, and Andrew Friedman. Ravana Sharfuddin was a superstar during the summer of 2019 when we were launching the research effort together in Hoover's D.C. office. Sarah Browning, an insightful historian, spent a graduate internship doing all of the presidential research for chapters 5 and 6. Zach Rutledge, an econometrics guru, worked with me on the state study. And my longtime friend Aaron Smith, who literally wrote the textbook on econometrics, offered invaluable guidance early on. The danger in naming professional colleagues is that there are so many who add real value to a book project like this that the author can never fairly identify some without neglecting others. But it'd be wrong to leave out thanks for the endless intellectual inspiration I've gotten from Garrett Jones, Brian Kaplan, Alex Narasta, Teresa Cardinal Brown, Andrew Seeley, Chris DeMuth, Ion Hirsealy, John Cochran, David Henderson, Bob Lighton, Ulrika Schade, Charles O'Reilly, Lori Hodrick, Andrew White, H.R. McMaster, Jim Mattis, Glenn Hubbard, Richard Epstein, Condi Rice, Tom Gilligan, John Taylor, George Schultz, and Eddie Lazier. George and Eddie passed away within weeks of one another, just before the final round of edits were complete. I'm going to miss sharing the published book with them more than words can say. Danny Heil and Tom Church are Hoover colleagues and have been the best of friends. Both read chapters here before anyone else, and Tom read the entire manuscript a few days after I typed the last word. If any typo remains, Tom found it, but I neglected to fix it. Many friends read chapter drafts and offered suggestions, most recently Steve Payson. Thanks to all. I have endless thanks for my agent, Jill Marshall. Jill always has time, wisdom, and kindness. James Cook and David Pervin, my editors at Oxford, were fantastic. David pushed me to give the book the shape it has now and to bring the stories to life. James had the unenviable task of hacking, revising, and reshaping my dreck into something that even I enjoyed reading. Thank you. Madeline Hansen was a tireless help in crafting every one of the chapters and deserves more thanks than anyone for helping me make this book what it is. Thanks, too, for organizing the talks I gave at Oxford and UCL in the fall of 2019 and to the students who shared the perspectives on America in the world. Madeleine and Ali Giyu worked with me to edit and produce the new Why America podcast as a companion to the book. Likewise, thanks to Richard Caldwell, who welcomed me to the University of Denver's Scrivener School for a lecture series that served as the backbone of the manuscript. And most of all, I want to share my deepest thanks to J.P. Conti for his support of my research and this book in particular, not only by endowing a fellowship at the Hoover Institution, but also by encouraging me wholeheartedly. Both of J.P.'s parents immigrated to the United States long ago, and I hope this book is worthy as a small legacy to the journey they took. Part 1, Life and Death. One century ago in 1921, as the American Colossus was emerging on the world stage, a populist backlash against foreign immigration was reinforced by fears of a global pandemic known as the Spanish flu. The backlash was bipartisan and emergency legislation passed the U.S. Congress overwhelmingly. That decision was strategically myopic, undercutting the source of America's surprisingly sudden strength. Indeed, immigrants and the sons of immigrants filled the ranks of the victorious U.S. Army coming home from Europe after World War I, and it was the sons of immigrants who would fill the ranks in World War II as well. Only during the Cold War era did America's leaders realize that its isolationist immigration laws were harmful. In 2021, the United States is stronger than ever on the world stage, yet ironically, finds itself in a situation that mirrors that of 1921, populism combined with a global pandemic. Even as Joe Biden's Democratic Party takes over the reins of the federal government, limits on foreign travel are more extreme than ever. Whole countries are all but blockaded, and the emergency justification for keeping out potentially diseased foreigners in the COVID-19 era will be hard to overcome. People, even enlightened voters in great democracies, are not very good at measuring short-term gains against long-term costs. This first of four parts of the book provides an introductory overview in Chapter 1, as well as two chapters that explore national security and the nature of threats. Immigration is far more central to the American identity and a cornerstone of its superpower than will ever be appreciated. Even though immigration tends to be at the heart of the nation's origin story of pilgrims, recent media narratives use words like invasion and foreign terrorism to justify building walls against supposed job thieves from poor countries. the consequences of the September 11, 2001 attacks on the Pentagon and New York's Twin Towers caused the shift in popular narratives in immigration, explored in Chapter 2, with an emphasis on the creation of a new, quote, homeland mentality. The analysis continues in the third chapter's review of National Security Strategy. Chapter 1. Oaths. I had always hoped that this land might become a safe and agreeable asylum to the virtuous and persecuted part of mankind, to whatever nation they might belong. George Washington. On a dry summer day long ago, I stood at attention in formation alongside 1,000 fellow cadets on the parade field at the United States Air Force Academy and took an oath. We said in unison, "I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same." Words that echo back to 1775, when soldiers in George Washington's Continental Army took such an oath. We do not fight for the soil or for a ruler or even for the nation. We fight for the revolutionary idea of democracy in which all human beings are equal and free. It dawned on me during my cadet days that civilians never take an oath, nor should they. Citizens in a free country should never be compelled with loyalty oaths, but those among us who volunteer to serve as warriors should pledge themselves to the Constitution and be indoctrinated about its principles. The irony is that my youthful reflections were wrong, at least in part. There's a group of American civilians required to take an oath. Immigrants. Foreign-born U.S. citizens must study the Constitution and pass a test that native-born Americans don't face. This is the price of admission for naturalized citizenship, and the Oath of Allegiance is the final step taken every week by tens of thousands of foreigners from every country on earth, a celebration of joining the American people. Weighing 50 pounds and standing 4 feet 0 inches tall, a refugee from Vietnam named France Hong took the citizenship oath when he was 8 years old, in the summer of 1982. It was 7 years after his family fled the communist invaders in Saigon, where his father had fought alongside the U.S. Army. France wasn't even 2 years old when he was resettled in Tumwater, Washington. He went on to receive a nomination to West Point, graduate in the top 1% of the class of 1995, deploy to Bosnia, fight in Afghanistan, work in the White House as legal counsel, and start multiple American companies that employ over 1,200 professionals across the fields of law, technology, and aerospace. France Hong epitomizes the United States' advantages as a nation of immigrants. France and I met long after we'd both left active duty service and become friends long before I learned that he was born abroad. But we share a love of country and a frustration that a fundamental source of America's greatness is being forgotten. I credit France uniquely among my friends and family who are foreign-born for compelling me to tell this story. This book is my effort to share a simple insight and makes this case to my fellow countrymen. Immigrants are the foundation of America's great power in global affairs. President Ronald Reagan remarked on this exceptionalism during his last full day in the White House. "You can go live in Germany or Turkey or Japan, but you cannot become a German, a Turk, or a Japanese. But anyone from any corner of the earth can come to live in America and become an American. Other countries may seek to compete with us, but in one vital area, as a beacon of freedom and opportunity that draws the people of the world, no country on earth comes close. This, I believe, is one of the most important sources of America's greatness. We lead the world because, unique among nations, we draw our people, our strength, from every country and every corner of the world." Sadly, the debate about immigration is polarized, but it also focuses only on concerns about domestic affairs. My unique perspective is that without its long tradition of robust and diverse immigration, the United States would have a weaker economy, a weaker military, and even weaker innovation. Migrants bring brawn, bravery, and brains to our side of great power competition, a truth that can be seen in America's rise to great power before and during the World Wars, during the Cold War against the Soviets, and in the present era as autocratic regimes in the Middle East and Asia rise. Even more surprisingly, most of the great changes in immigration policy were intertwined with foreign affairs, from the 1920s closed doors following World War I to the 1960s reopening and diversification as a Cold War strategy. The Founding Fathers had very deep insights on the nature of man and the subtle institutions of democracy. I worry often that we natives tend to forget what America is, but immigrants remember. The American ideal is why they strive to come. Failure is forgetting. In the United States, the political debate over immigration has become impossibly mired in partisanship. Both sides are guilty, Republican and Democrat. Politicians are having an increasingly confused debate that mixes illegal and legal immigration while putting impractical symbolism over common sense pragmatism. Serious legislation is nowhere in sight. While the debate tends to be about economics as well as culture, most people forget how immigration is fundamentally related to national security. And not just in negative ways. Pundits such as Michelle Malkin are quick to paint a picture of a terrorist invasion, but blithely ignore the thousands of immigrants who join the U.S. Army and fight the jihadis. They forget who Americans are. The hot debate is hardly original to this era. As Joe Klein wrote in the New York Times, nativism has almost always been a minor chord in American politics. The issue will be debated decades from now, just as it has been every decade since the Revolutionary War. Modern nativists such as Mark Krikorian warned that the extraordinary prosperity of the United States means that mass, unskilled migration is no longer compatible with our economy or our people. Truly unique to this era is that the entire world is going through a technological revolution that is deeper and wider than the innovations that drove agricultural and industrial revolutions. Sam Huntington, the eminent political scientist, warned in numerous books before his death in 2008 that America itself had changed and was no longer a settler country, that its classic ideal of e pluribus unum was being supplanted by an internal tribalism. The British economist Paul Collier suggests that globalism has lowered the cost of travel so sharply that this century will likely experience a destabilizing exodus of people from the poor South to the rich North, with potentially dire consequences for the institution that made so many northern countries prosperous in the first place. These are serious concerns, and we will take them seriously in this book. But shouldn't we begin with an accounting of the proven strength that immigrants contribute before engaging with hypothetical threats? The first time I was asked to add my voice to the debate was in 2005, when former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese invited me to join a group of conservative scholars at the Heritage Foundation. Our objective was to find common ground. My role was to be the voice of economists, who tend to make up the more libertarian wing of the conservative coalition. At the time, George W. Bush was starting his second term as president, and Heritage wanted to help him craft a comprehensive immigration reform bill. We failed. With frustration and bemusement, I've now witnessed firsthand three presidents and many more Congresses try and fail to reform the deeply dysfunctional rules and regulations that are known as the U.S. immigration system. I can tell you exactly why the effort keeps failing. Frankly, many legislators want reform to fail because unsolved problems are invaluable for election campaigns. It may be cynical to suggest disingenuous politicians pretend to advance legislation by nodding seriously during hearings and asking serious questions while secretly slow-rolling the process and sabotaging complex bills with not-so-innocent amendments. But that's the political game. And anyone who really wants to fix U.S. immigration has to understand the political game in order to win. Meanwhile, the tone of the immigration debate has grown darker, and not just in the United States. Refugees from Syria's civil war, which displaced around half the country's population of 22 million people, and Africa, plagued by civil wars, terrorism, corruption, and poverty, started flooding into Europe in 2011, exposing the European Union's weak borders. The inability of governments throughout the continent to control that surge added to a sense among many Europeans that they were losing control of their own societies, an unease that sparked a revolt by the British people to abandon the surprisingly unstable European Union in a vote known as Brexit. In the United States, the presidential election of 2016 exposed the immigration debate as increasingly ugly, alarmist, and even paranoid. Curtailing illegal immigration makes sense, but I've come to worry that the backlash poses a danger because it might easily lead to draconian restrictions on legal migration. That is precisely what happened when the U.S. immigration debate turned ugly and paranoid in the 1920s. At the time of this writing, the U.S. Senate is considering a bill that would slash legal immigration by half or worse. If the world's democracies actually turn inward, particularly if Americans become sharply isolationist, I believe a global recession is sure to follow. Worse, the nature of the American identity will change, and over the long term, that may well end the country's exceptional role in the world. Two facts about American exceptionalism. President Trump often asked why the United States is the only country in the world that has ridiculous immigration policies. During a speech in October 2018, he threatened to end birthright citizenship with an executive order, even though it's enshrined in the Constitution. He said incorrectly that the United States is the only country that recognizes every child born on its soil as a full citizen. Even though most countries in the Western Hemisphere have birthright citizenship, Trump was right that America is unique, even exceptional, but not in the way he thought. Two facts about American exceptionalism must be reconciled to understand the immigration issue. Fact one, the United States is the richest nation in the world. It also happens to be the richest nation in history, and the word rich has many meanings here. Money, yes, but more than that. America's powerful economy serves as the foundation of its superpower status and funds its dominant military strength. There are many, many factors that explain economic growth and many, many books about it, including one I co-authored with Glenn Hubbard called Balance, The Economics of Great Powers from Ancient Rome to Modern America. But take my word for the time being that there is no debate about American economic dominance at this moment in history. Fact two. The United States welcomes more immigrants than any other country, just counting the legal immigrants, 1 million every year. Yet relative to population, the United States is not the most open. European citizens are moving across the open internal borders of the EU, making its nations appear more open. But in absolute numbers of permanent new citizens and global diversity, no other country comes close. American openness to global immigration mirrors the great powers of history, notably ancient Rome and Ottoman Turkey. If only the United Kingdom had opened its citizenship and representation in Parliament to the colonists in North America and its subjects in India, it would be the subject of this book. Alas. Are these two exceptional features related? I think so. The premise of this book is that they are far more than a coincidence. I argue that being a nation of immigrants is a fundamental cause of extraordinary prosperity and military power for the United States. Not only is immigration central to American identity, but it is also what military strategists call a force multiplier. Unlike others who narrowly look at migration patterns as a demographic or economic question, I make the case that immigration is an essential ingredient in the grand strategy that makes the United States a dominant superpower. Despite contentious newspaper headlines casting America as cold and indifferent, the reality is that every year, 1 million people born elsewhere are granted permanent legal residency and the right to take the oath as naturalized American citizens. More important, this welcoming policy is based on deep public support for immigration. Opinion polls reveal that Americans support diversity and immigration more than any other country in the world, with 70% expressing support for continuing the current level of legal immigration or increasing it. The next few chapters will expand on this history and how the United States developed its current legal openness. Democratic leaders such as Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and Lyndon Johnson understood the vitality of immigration for U.S. power, and support for immigration has been even more central to Republican Party leaders from George W. Bush all the way back to Abraham Lincoln. Interestingly, the chief executives consistently rated at the top of presidential greatness rankings were proponents of greater immigration. They recognized that raw power needs the three things that immigrants bring: brawn, bravery, and brains. George Washington and the other founding fathers who declared independence from Great Britain were motivated not only by trade restrictions and a lack of representation in Parliament, but also because the king was restricting migration to the colonies. He feared that they were too popular and growing too quickly. It must be said that the founding fathers fought for unlimited immigration. In the early years of the American government, Congress obsessed over ways to attract more immigrants from Europe because a larger population was the only guarantee of military strength that could protect the young country. Let's dig into the first fact, that the economic power of the United States is unmatched. Critics of immigration on the political right and left share an assumption that the United States has become weaker in recent decades. Bernie Sanders, for example, has been mildly hostile to immigration, legal and illegal, his entire career because he and other labor leftists believe that migrants take jobs from natives. Meanwhile, Donald Trump and other nativists speak of immigration as an invasion with dire implications for jobs, but also culture and safety. Later in the book, I'll explore the impact immigrants have on the economy, but for now, I want to emphasize how wrong the underlying premise of U.S. economic weakness is. The United States has a stronger economy than any country in the world, by far. Only two other societies can produce on the same scale as the United States, as measured by gross domestic product, or GDP, China and the European Union. Yet, each lags America's total economic output. Each does not invent as many technologies, and most important, each has significantly lower GDP per person. In the United States, GDP per capita is $59,500. England's is $44,000. Japan's is $43,000. Germany's is $50,000. And China? GDP per person in China is just under $17,000. America isn't just rich, it is prosperous. The nation's GDP grows as if growth were something easy. But this is a relatively new phenomenon in the scope of recorded history. Economic growth was so rare as to be negligible, even unimaginable, until the Industrial Age erupted in the early 1800s. Growth emerged from Enlightenment institutions of widespread literacy, the scientific method, and free markets. And by the middle of the 19th century, it was clearly measurable and appreciated as a modern wonder. Within a century, the vast internal markets of North America, its universities, and its openness to people yearning to breathe free from all around the world enabled millions of new homes or even the poorest citizens with marvels of electricity, plumbing, and hot water. The wonders continued as Americans patented their discoveries of television, batteries, air conditioning, even flight. Today, American citizens take all this and more for granted. While foreigners witness relentless technological and cultural surplus, personal computers in the 1980s, the internet in the 1990s, electric cars, Hollywood movies, YouTube videos, Amazon markets, the U.S. economy is not only thriving, but also leading. And it seems everyone knows about it, but Americans. Instead, our political system is locked in a cynical debate that assumes things are getting worse and has settled into the question of whom to blame. Sadly, foreigners make easy scapegoats, especially for imaginary ills. An anecdote. I was a luncheon speaker to a group of Republican women a few years ago, and my talk on immigration was warmly received. My presentation touted the positive economic effects of migrant workers and entrepreneurs, while also admitting the challenges of labor market competition that scholars have documented are real concerns, especially for less skilled native-born workers. Most people in the audience liked the talk, and some even cheered, but there were a handful of pointed questions during Q&A. Afterward, a meek lady wanted to talk to me privately. She said, Dr. Kane, I trust you on the economic issues because you're an expert, but what about culture? Don't you worry that these immigrants from Mexico are eroding America's Judeo-Christian culture? Her question caught me by surprise, given her meek, unassuming persona.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?